to Hotel Bar Sessions, the podcast where three philosophers sit down at the end of a long conference day to chop it up at the hotel bar, which, as we all know, is where the real philosophy happens.
Welcome back to Hotel Bar Sessions. I'm Jason Reed, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts Rick Lee and Lee Johnson, and this week we're going to be talking about boredom, or if you prefer the fancier version, ennui. Before we get to that, let's get our drink orders and our rants and raves in. So, Lee, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
I'm just going to have two fingers of Buffalo Trace today, and I'm actually raving. I mean, it's sort of about friend of the podcast, Emma Bianchi, but in particular, this game that we made up while I was visiting her in London called Cult Leader or Cult Follower. So I have been talking about how shocked I was that there are so many documentaries about cults, and a lot of them are new cults,
yeah.
Like, you know, invented in the last few years. Maybe it's not that hard to start a cult, you know, like maybe this is something we should consider. And then somehow this evolved into just categorizing everybody that we knew as either someone who would be a cult leader or someone who would be a cult follower. So this is a fun game. I'm giving it away for free. Please practice it with your friends. Rick, what about you?
I am going to have a Hemingway daiquiri, and this week I am ranting about the North Carolina system of higher education. North Carolina, like many red states, has politicized their public university system, and they've gone to incredible extremes. So one of their new things is they're moving University of North Carolina Asheville, which was their liberal arts institution in the system, away from being a liberal arts institution and more toward, well, let's be honest, vo-tech. And I think a lot of red states are doing this. It's really short-sighted, and we need to start paying more and more attention to this.
Yeah.
Jason, what about you?
I'm going to have a Allagash White, my go-to beer from the great state of Maine, and I am going to rave about one of my favorite films, Marathon Man. I watched it again recently, and first of all, we just need more films where grad students fight Nazis. I want that to be the next thing that replaces superheroes. Grad students fighting Nazis and the duplicitous American government, which has enabled the Nazis to continue to go on living. That really, I think, should be the next big trend. You heard it here first, folks. Grad students versus Nazis. So, Lee, we're talking about boredom, but what do you want to talk about? Entertain us with boredom.
Well, you know, I was thinking that most of our podcasts really are about big issues, you know, interesting topics, provocative conversations, or important matters. But the truth is that the overwhelming majority of our day-to-day lives is dominated by boredom, tedium, lethargy, lassitude, or in the fancier French term, ennui. Now, ennui is a term that's rooted in French literature, but it's evolved into a philosophical concept that delves into the depths of existential boredom and the disquiet that arises from a sense of purposelessness. The word itself translates to listlessness, but its implications extend beyond that, really. It captures a profound existential malaise, a weariness that permeates one's entire being. Now, philosophically, ennui is often linked to the human condition and the quest for meaning. So existentialist thinkers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus grappled with this idea of ennui as an aspect of the human experience. In a world devoid of inherent meaning or purpose, individuals are basically left just to confront the void. And that leads to this sense of disillusionment and discontent. But it also finds resonance in various cultural and artistic expressions. Romantic literature, for example, often portrays ennui as a complex emotion, sometimes intertwined with a sense of longing or melancholy. And the works of poets like Baudelaire and Rimbaud explore the ennui of urban life and the search for meaning in the face of modernity. So the philosophical concept of ennui encapsulates a very profound sense of boredom that arises from the human struggle to find meaning in an inherently meaningless world. it may seem strange to devote an entire podcast episode to boredom. So I'm going to count on you guys to keep this entertaining. I guess the first question I want to ask you guys is, when was the last time you were bored? I'm thinking in particular of the fact that in our day and age, we're constantly surrounded by machines and devices, attention merchants that do everything they possibly can to make sure that we're never bored. Are they successful?
Well, I was thinking about this question of boredom and asking myself, is there a boredom that comes even in and through these devices you're mentioning? Like, is doom scrolling a kind of boredom?
Mm.
It's not the picture you might have of boredom of sort of staring off in the middle distance with nothing to preoccupy you or entertain you. But to me, it almost seems more boring than that because you're searching desperately for something that might pique your attention. I mean, scrolling through social media is the new channel surfing. You're not really engaging in an activity for its own entertainment. You're hoping against hope that something will pop up that will change your state and change the way you're engaging with it. And you'll see something worth reading or worth looking at. It's not an antidote to boredom. It's a technologically mediated form of boredom.
I wonder if it's necessary to pull apart two aspects to boredom. And I'm thinking about this, Jason, because you use the word boring. I think when we say that something is boring, what we mean is that it's not interesting or exciting. But when I say that I am bored, I could mean that I'm not interested in anything. But I also think, at least historically, boredom was also the experience of time going so slowly that it seems as if 5 minutes is an hour and so on. I've had this experience, for example, in faculty meetings where I'm sitting there and I swear to God, a half hour has gone by, but it's really only been 10 minutes. So I think boredom is both not being interested in something and also time slowing down. In that sense, then, I find a lot of the machines that I might use to distract myself boring. I find myself often doom scrolling the news, and I'm like, this is so stupid, and I'm not even reading it. Stories are flying by me. And so I think if they're trying to alleviate boredom, then they're bad at it. And if they're trying to be interesting, some of them are also bad at it.
I want to go back to Jason's first description of boredom, you know, sort of staring off into the middle distance. Right? That to me does seem like boredom. And I'm becoming convinced as you guys are talking that maybe doom scrolling is a kind of boredom too. But when I think of being bored, I think of something like sitting in the waiting room at the DMV. That's a kind of boredom that motivates despair, right? This like, what is the point of everything? Why am I here? Why am I doing this? And I'm not sure that that's really about whether my attention is being occupied or not.
Well, I mean, imagine you're sitting in the waiting room at the DMV and you're with a very close friend. They're telling you a story that is very compelling. And then all of a sudden it's your turn. And you're like, wow, that took no time at all. I think you wouldn't say you were bored there. And so what's the difference? Isn't it that your attention was captured?
I don't know. I think the difference is the difference between a boredom of nothing is capturing my attention and a boredom that is depressing.
Yeah.
A boredom that has more philosophical heft to it, existential heft to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of a song by the Fugs. I think it's simply called Nothing. And the song just goes like this. Sunday, nothing. Monday, nothing. Tuesday and Wednesday, nothing. You get the point.
Yes.
And I think that's an expression of a kind of boredom. But I do take your point about the despair that I don't always feel even when I would say I'm bored.
Mm.
I don't know how to quite put my finger on what that despair is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that because I am uninterested in anything and there's nothing interesting, I feel like I'm hovering over an abyss suddenly.
Yeah.
Like an abyss of nothingness.
Right. Because one of the things that happens when our attention is captured is that we're given meaning. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we don't have to look for it. We don't have to wonder what it is. We don't have to say to ourselves, what's the point of it all? The point is right there in the TikTok. Right? So I know what it is. But when I have to search for meaning and it doesn't present itself to me immediately or in an attention capturing way, then yeah, I agree with you. There's a kind of vertigo to that.
Mm. We tend to divide boredom between the object and the person. Something is boring or someone is bored. Mm. And there is a way in which that gets moralized. Like there's that saying, which is often attributed to parents from a bygone era, of only boring people are bored, that you should be able to entertain yourself. And to some extent, there is some truth to that. There are times when I've been sitting, staring in the middle distance, but I got a lot going on in my head and it's all very interesting and I'm not bored. Like I've, you know, sat through entire bus trips and not cracked open a book or done anything because I'm thinking about stuff and it's interesting to me. Yeah. But then there are other times when the same lack of external stimuli could drive me up the wall because there's nothing to engage me. So we go back and forth between the subject and the object, attributing which one is the cause. But it's really about a relation between the two. Because I've had times when I've picked up books that I otherwise might find interesting, but I just can't engage them because of something else going on. I think the DMV is an interesting example. The DMV is a place that you don't even think anything interesting is going to happen. Like there's nothing there. And it keeps you impatient, so it keeps you aware enough of the passage of time. You can't crack open that book you brought, but you can't engage yourself with what's happening or distract yourself from what's happening. You're stuck in a presence that doesn't do anything for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's remarkable to me that Kafka never wrote a novel called The Waiting Room, because it seems very, in that sense, Kafka-esque. It's also worth pointing out, I think, that at least in German, it's not the case in Polish, but in German, to be bored is reflexive. Hmm. Like literally, I bored myself, or I am boring myself. And I think there's maybe a bit of moralization, as Jason was pointing out in this, because to go back to Jason's bus example, what's the difference? Well, in one case, he was able to generate interesting content in his head, as it were, whereas in the other case, he failed. And so that's a failure on your part. You have failed to unbore yourself.
You know, I think that there are times when I need to be bored in order to, as Jason was mentioning earlier, have some time to think, to work through whatever is going on in my head. This is something that I have said many times about watching television, is that sometimes I will watch television and it's really just there to occupy my face while I think. And, you know, somebody will come in the room and say, what are you watching? And I literally don't even know. I don't even know what's on. Even though I'm staring at it, I am watching it. I think now scrolling TikTok does that for me. It's kind of like, all right, I'm just going to do this. It occupies my attention, but that gives me time to actually think. But again, that's not the kind of boredom that inspires malaise like the DMV.
Right. I wouldn't even call that boredom. Doing nothing is not the same as boredom or being bored. I'm often doing nothing and I'm not bored at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I walk a lot to campus and it's just under an hour walk. And I used to listen to podcasts as I'm walking. Recently, I decided to stop that. And I realized that I was afraid I would be bored just walking. But it turns out I'm not. You know, now I could tell you things I saw, whereas before I couldn't. And I think in a strange way, listening to the podcasts, I was more bored than I realized. Hmm. Not our podcast. That's never boring. But I mean, those other assholes.
Did you know that Hotel Bard Podcast is more than just a podcast? We are a fully online cross-brand synergy platform of content creation. Actually, that's not true. Those words are meaningless. But you can follow us on the app formerly known as Twitter at Hotel Bar Podcast. There you can find the handles of all the co-hosts as well. You can follow us all or pick your favorite. If by the time you hear this, Elon Musk has burned down the servers to collect the insurance, you can also find us on Facebook or YouTube. Just look for Hotel Bar Sessions. Wherever you find us on social media, you can contact us with ideas, complaints, and questions. You can also email us anytime at hotelbarpodcast@gmail.com or visit our interactive page at hotelbarpodcast.com. No matter how you get in contact with us, we're always glad to hear from you.
Rick, I want to pick up on something that you said in the last segment. It surprised you that Kafka never wrote anything entitled The Waiting Room. You know, Voltaire in The Prodigal Son said, all genres are permitted except for the boring genre. And I do think this is one of the really interesting things about boredom. It's very hard to represent it. Maybe it's because boredom is so idiosyncratic, right? Like what's boring to me might not be boring to you, but also the experience of it, once you start talking about it, once you try to dramatize it, it's not boring.
Right.
Right. And also you're stuck with the idea that if you really did a great job, like the novel that perfectly described boredom, wouldn't it be on some level unreadable?
Right.
Who would want to read it?
Right.
So there's a real tension there. Although I do think it can be done. I was just teaching John Lanchester's novel, The Wall, you know, which is this dystopian post-ecological collapse novel. And the first part of it is all about life on this wall, which is a wall set up to keep ecological refugees out of this unnamed country. And a lot is done in trying to describe and convey, and it does a very good job, I think, of this time on the wall. But in order to do so, it plays with different devices. It writes poems about it. It shifts and repeats certain phrases and tries to depict boredom, but in a way that, as you said, is kind of interesting.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it kind of fails itself at the exact moment it succeeds.
I also think in Camus' The Stranger, maybe even the entire novel is a depiction of boredom. Things happen. Yeah, now that's weird. What mostly happens is the description of boredom, which is, as we're pointing out, interesting. But what about, for example, Andy Warhol's, what is it, 15-hour film or something, that it's just the Empire State Building?
Right.
That seems to me like a depiction of boredom that is also boring.
Right. But the minute you thematize that it's a film about boredom, it's no longer boring.
Right.
Right? I think that what we're saying about trying to represent or incorporate boredom in film or literature or whatever is also true of philosophy. It's actually surprising to me, given how common this experience is in human life, that we don't have more theorization of boredom. But again, the minute you start talking about it as a concept, it's not boredom. It's interesting. It's like trying to grab a handful of fog, you know?
Yeah. Although, at the same time, we don't theorize boredom. Many people think what we do is boring.
Yeah.
And I do think there's something to that. I mean, I was thinking the other day about how I'm utterly convinced in my teaching life that there's something in philosophy that would engage any student. Like, some people might be more interested in ethical issues. Some people might be epistemology or knowledge and so on and so on and so forth. But the problem is, when we teach, we can't do this bespoke kind of like, here's the philosophy. You know, we're teaching to a large audience and we're trying to find some kind of engagement. But I do believe that philosophy isn't boring, but I understand that it can seem boring. Mm-hmm. And it can seem boring in the sense that for some people, the kind of questions that we're dealing with just don't engage them at all. Adorno talks about boredom as objective dullness, but says that this is connected to the fact that the things people find boring has to do with the inability to translate them into anything that would connect to the life they're living. Mm. I do think that sometimes, you know, when philosophy seems boring, it's just like, what does all this have to do with me? The inability to forge a connection is, in some sense, a kind of boredom.
Okay, I think that my job on this episode is clearly just to point out paradoxes, so here's another one.
That's awfully close to on the one hand, on the other.
Fair enough. But just to get back to what Jason was saying, I mean, the paradoxical thing is that when people say philosophy is boring, what they're saying is, what is the point of it? Which is, ta-da, doing philosophy. Like, you can't capture boredom. That's the thing.
All right, let me test this out. I teach medieval philosophy. It's one of my areas of expertise. And sometimes I teach a text by the medieval philosopher Duns Scotus. Duns Scotus is very complicated, long-winded. The arguments are intricate. And students in one particular class that I remember were complaining to me that Scotus is not relatable.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about that for a second. And then I said, you realize that a relation has two sides to it, right? Nothing is related to itself. And so when you're saying it's unrelatable, maybe you ought to think, you're unrelatable and the text doesn't want to relate to you. And so I'm wondering, was that a way of them saying it's boring?
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a way in and that's boring. But if that's boring, then to go back to something Lee said earlier, that's not the boring that keeps me up at night or makes me think that nothing has any meaning or purpose.
Yeah, that's more of a, I would prefer not to.
Yeah. Right?
This is just not something that I want to do. It's not real boredom. Although now, of course, I'm just imagining in my head, Duns Scotus coming into the classroom and being like, what have you done for me lately?
Right. Mr. Scotus, if you're nasty.
Scotus, if you're listening, call us.
Yeah, right.
So in that sense, philosophy is boring. But I don't know that anyone is claiming that it's boring in the sense that it does nothing. No one could possibly be interested in it or find it interesting. Mm-hmm. And there, I mean, to go back to what I said to students, that's a relation. When I say that's boring, I'm talking about a relation. It's boring always for me, and someone else might find it interesting.
I mean, that's an interesting point, because now I think we're edging closer to the existential malaise part of boredom. Because if I can't engage something, that is, I think, going to motivate me to, you know, confront the fact that maybe there's just meaninglessness out there. Like, I can't even engage this.
Yeah. So if I can't engage this, okay, that might be one thing. But if nothing is engaging, then I think all of a sudden I'm way into the meaninglessness of all things.
Right. Because if I ask the question, what's the point? And nothing arises as an answer, that's the malaise.
Right.
Although it seems to me that in the boredom around philosophy, and Duns Scotus is a good example of this, the two things you often hear are, one, that there are just all these fine-tuned distinctions that don't seem to make a difference.
Right.
Or it's all the same. It's all just God, blood. I do think that it's interesting that part of boredom is either failing to see any differences or seeing differences that don't make a difference.
Mm. Right.
And I think that this is true, not just of philosophy, but when people are not engaged by a particular genre of film or genre of music, usually their response is that it all sounds the same to them. Mm. They don't see the difference between name whatever. You know, they don't see the difference between John Ford and Anthony Mann's Westerns, or the difference between the blues played by Howlin' Wolf or Lightnin' Hopkins. You know, they just all sounds the same. And I do think there's something about that description, like maybe it does sound the same to them. You have to train yourself to be able to see the differences in things to make those differences matter. Colleen, my wife, she's a surfer, and she sometimes watches competitive surfing. And I try to watch it with her, but I realize after a while, I just don't see what she sees. Because I don't do it. I don't see the differences of footwork, timing, etc. that she sees. So it's almost like I might as well just be watching the waves crash.
Right.
To me, it reminds me of Spinoza's point, what a surprise, that you have to like experience a lot of different things to be able to even understand things. You can't just see one version of something to understand it. When you engage in any kind of activity, the first thing that happens is you begin to see differences that other people don't see. Mm. And those differences seem meaningful, because I think on the other side of this is the proliferation of pointless differences. You know, like, oh, they're just making all these distinctions, but why do they matter? And I think a particular kind of engagement of interest is both seeing the differences and recognizing why the differences make a difference.
So would you say then that it's always the case that if I'm bored by something, to some degree, I don't understand it? I liked your example of surfing and sports in general. You know, you'll hear people say, I can't watch golf.
Right.
It's boring.
Right.
Or tennis or soccer.
Baseball.
You know, but if you understand baseball, right, if you understand those games, they're not boring. And part of the reason that a lot of times people are bored watching the game is because they don't see all of these, as you said, differences that make a difference.
There's a Simpsons episode where they cut from the American commentator on a soccer game to the Latin American commentator. And it's the same thing is happening. And the American's like, he passes to him. Then they cut to the Latin American one. And he's at the edge of his seat, like, oh, he passes. And it's the exact same thing, but it's being experienced in a fundamentally different way.
Right.
But I think that seeing the differences allows you to say, this matters. which is a different way of saying this is meaningful or important. And so now we're back to the question of meaning again. I play golf and I watch golf and I like watching golf, but that's because I know the difference between having the ball 4 feet to the right on that hole versus where it ends up. That difference is really important. It might be the difference between getting a birdie and getting a bogey. Therefore, it matters to me whether the ball is there or over there, or it matters to me whether it's a draw or a fade. If I don't know anything about that, then it's not meaningful. But that then leads to the question, should I know something about that if I'm not interested in it, right? I might be completely uninterested in educating myself about golf or philosophy for that matter.
It also leaves aside the question, is that always the case? Is it always the case that when I'm bored, it's because I haven't put in the effort to know about the thing or to engage the thing? Because I do think that there are things that we know about and still find boring, you know, knitting, for example, you know, crocheting. My grandmother used to crochet constantly. I know how to do it. I've sat with her and done it, and I can see how somebody else would find it interesting, but I find it incredibly boring. People could say the same thing about, I don't know, playing cards, you know, anything. Walking.
Right. Well, and I think also within philosophy, there are some philosophers that I find incredibly boring that people find very interesting. And I'm a specialist in, I think, what has to be recognized as the single most boring period in the history of Western philosophy.
You'll notice the silence of counter-arguments there.
No, don't say it's not true.
Yeah, but in my hands, it becomes interesting.
Well, of course it does. Of course it does. Do you think that it's possible to be happily bored? Is boredom always dissatisfying?
See, this is the moment where students find philosophy uninteresting because they get to a point where they say, those are just words. But, I mean, we're trained to be specific. And I don't think I would use the word boredom, to go back to something I said earlier, in the case where I'm simply doing nothing.
Yeah.
In those cases where I'm simply doing nothing, Jason being on the bus and occupying his mind with deep thoughts, I'm happy in that situation, but I would never say I was bored. Mm-hmm. So I would say I don't think you can be happily bored.
Okay, yeah. Because that was the question I was asking. I'm asking about the affect of boredom. Is there ever an instance in which you recognize that you are bored and you are not at the same time dissatisfied?
Well, your knitting example kind of made me think about that. There are activities that people do that don't fully engage them, but that's part of the enjoyment. Like where your hands are occupied, but you've done it enough that you don't need to focus on everything you're doing. But I guess I think of those activities as a baseline for another kind of activity. You know, like a lot of games, card games or tabletop games, you know, some of them exist to fully engage people, and some of them exist because otherwise you'd just be sitting around the table with a bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. And somehow to have something minimally going on makes the conversation flow much more easily than just, hey, you want to come over to my house and we'll sit around a table and stare at each other until someone says something interesting? Right. You know, that seems like a really weird thing to say, but if you invite people over to play a game or play cards or like a knitting circle, somehow the fact that you're doing one thing that doesn't fully engage you gives you room to engage in a different way.
Right.
Sounds like you're agreeing with us, though, that there is no happy boredom.
There's happy routine, but not happy boredom.
Yeah.
Your example reminds me of the fact that people used to sit around and listen to the radio. They weren't listening to the radio while washing dishes or cooking dinner because, you know, at one point the radio was an appliance. It was a piece of furniture and it was in the living room. And Saturday night, you'd sit there and listen to the I don't know, Punch and Judy show or whatever. Mm-hmm. And for me today to think that I'm just going to sit and listen to the radio, whether it's music or speaking, I can't even imagine it. That is the most boring thing I could ever imagine. Even talking about the idea makes me feel like I'm suspended over an abyss.
That's interesting, because I 100% could imagine doing that. I mean, you know, not staring at a radio, but I can imagine sitting in my backyard or anywhere and putting my headphones in and just listening to the news or podcasts and not doing anything else.
Yeah. Although it's funny that I guess you're basically doing the same thing if I go to a concert, right? I'm just sitting there listening to music. Right. But, you know, Adorno makes this point in this essay called On the Fetish Character of Music and the Regression of Hearing, that context makes all the difference. One of his arguments is that music has become something else because now it's become background for the other things we're doing. And so we haven't become bored, but now it's boring because all music should just be background.
I do think the concert is different than just listening to music. I mean, you know, it's theater too. And
that's right.
As I've said many times before, the greatest thing about live theater is that something can always go wrong. And whether you're looking for that to happen or not, that is at least something exciting about live performances.
One time I was at a classical music concert. One of our friends was in the orchestra playing violin. The concert hadn't started, and the members of the orchestra came out, and they were tuning up and warming up. One of the percussionists came out and had a row of triangles in front of herself. And Monique said, "You know, don't you think that person is just waiting for their triangle moment?" And wouldn't you know it, in one piece they played, there was like a fucking triangle solo. That person was playing for 5 minutes, three different triangles. But that's just the example of how it's theater, right? Yeah. Now suddenly the person's doing something, you get to see how they're playing and how they hold their instrument and so on. And that's different than just sitting there in my living room listening to music.
Yeah, and I mean, that probably makes you want to understand the triangle more.
Like, yeah.
Why would somebody choose? Why? How do people choose that life? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm going back a little bit to, I think, the point that Jason brought up, that there is this connection between boredom and not understanding something. And I'm now thinking that in addition to the DMV, another scenario in which I could think that I would feel overwhelming boredom is if I was sitting in a room where everyone's having a conversation, but it's in a language I don't understand. Mm. Maybe for a few minutes, you know, you could just kind of watch the interactions and think about people's different personalities or guess what they might be talking about. But at some point, I think, you know, if somebody said, "You have to do this for a month," that would be insufferable.
And I've been twice in my life in situations like that. Once when I taught for 8 weeks in China, and another time when I first moved to Poland. I eventually learned Polish. And let me just tell you, Lee, everyone's talking about the same thing all around the world. And it's all fucking boring.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I don't find it boring, but I've never understood the weird American opposition to people speaking in languages they don't understand. I love it because it just immediately goes into the background. Mm. I don't have to half listen to their conversation. What I don't love is when it's a language that I've spent some time studying and then I'm like, oh, caught a word.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I should understand more of this, but I don't, and I get frustrated. If it's a language that I've never engaged with, like Korean, that I'm just like, oh, it's in the background,
yeah,
and I don't hear what these people have to say.
And then it becomes like music.
Mm-hmm.
But notice, that would only be boring if nothing else were capturing your attention. If you're at the DMV in Seoul, then I think that is the height of all possible boredom.
And some real confusion.
I mean, the title of that scene is What is the Point? Here at the hotel bar, Rick, Jason, and I like to pour philosophy straight into your ears. We're an independent and ad-free podcast, and we'd like to keep it that way. But the only way we can do that is with listener support. You can help us defray some of our production costs by signing up to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. There are several levels of monthly donations there that you can sign up for, and every one of them helps us keep raising our glasses to deep conversations. If you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, or several one-time donations, just visit our website at hotelbarpodcast.com, where you can find links to support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App, and you can keep enjoying our tipsy philosophy and sobering insights. Existentialist philosophers are pretty well known for discussing ennui, often as an example of what they call the absurd. So I'm thinking of people like Camus and Kafka and Jean-Paul Sartre. They combine this boredom and existential malaise with the absurdity of the meaninglessness of life. I'm curious whether or not our experience of ennui is really absurd. Or rather, is our experience of reflecting on the experience of ennui or boredom absurd?
So the question is ennui absurd, or is the philosophy of ennui absurd?
Exactly, yes.
Or is it also a question of, is there a necessary relation between absurdity and boredom? Because for me, having to engage in an act that seems pointless, like having to be on hold to clear up some bureaucratic slip-up that seems pointless and meaningless in the first place, seems just like frustrating. Frustrating is not boredom. Mm-hmm. I guess I wonder about the connection between absurdity and boredom.
Again, paradox. I'm going to have a little clicker. It's like every time I say paradox. But again, paradox is that, of course, at least the existentialist claim is that boredom motivates us to ask this what is the point question, and right. then the answer to that is there is no point, right? That's the absurdity. But the moment we ask that question, it seems to me the experience is no longer of boredom. Now you're reflecting on the experience of boredom, and that's absurd.
So just let me try to tease this out a little bit, Lee.
Right.
What you just said is I have an experience of boredom, and I don't recognize that what I'm experiencing is the meaninglessness of things. And then when I reflect on it, then I realize that my boredom was based on the meaninglessness of things.
Close. I think what I'm saying is that boredom motivates us to ask whether or not anything has any meaning.
Mm.
And if what occurs to us is no, no, everything is meaningless, that right. seems absurd to us. I mean, let's just pick the classic example, Sisyphus. Sisyphus is rolling the rock up the hill. Every time he gets to the top, it rolls back down. Rolls the rock up the hill again, it rolls back down. Now, that's boring, right? At some point, that would involve an experience of boredom. What Camus tells us is this is going to motivate Sisyphus to be like, what's the point of this?
Right.
And there are two options. Well, there's one answer, but two options for responding to that answer. But the answer is there is no point. This is just absurd.
Right.
Camus, of course, tells us that we have to imagine Sisyphus happy, that he sort of accepts that there's no point to it, that it's meaningless. But I think for most people, the confrontation with the meaninglessness of life is despairing.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting in Camus' position, and I think it also comes up at the end of The Stranger, where Meursault is finally in prison and looking out the window of his cell and recognizes, I think the phrase is, the benign indifference of the universe. And there's a kind of happiness or peace that comes with recognizing that there is no point. What's odd and maybe Lee paradoxical is that that means what's interesting is that there is no point.
Right.
So strangely, the recognition of absurdity suddenly seems less absurd because the point is that there is no point.
I'm really going to have to get a bell to ring every time I say this, but the claim, the point is that there is no point, is a paradox, of course.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the absurd becomes less absurd. We have to make a decision about how we're going to respond to the absurdity of human existence.
Right.
But my original point was that now we are so far away from boredom, right?
Right.
So this connection between boredom and the absurd, I don't think boredom is absurd. I think what's absurd is the reflection on boredom.
Right.
Which is not boring.
Right. And that the absurdity is not part of the boredom. It's the result of thinking about my boredom. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, crap, what if nothing matters?
Right. It reminds me of this passage from Schopenhauer's On the Sufferings of the World, where he says that want and ennui are the two poles of human life, and that the further we escape from one, the nearer we inevitably are drawn to the other. So it seems to me that we're always trying to escape boredom in the same way that we're trying to escape want.
Mm-hmm.
But that as with want, as soon as we start to move away from boredom, again, it's like trying to grab a handful of fog. There's nothing there.
These two poles are both poles of nothingness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So want is a condition of having nothing. And then ennui is the experience of nothingness. And, you know, Schopenhauer is famously a pessimist, and I think this is an incredibly pessimistic view of human existence.
Is it, though? Is it pessimistic?
Well, I think it's pessimistic because the fundamental idea is the only thing worse than nothing happening is something happening.
Right.
Because if the only thing that's on the opposite side of ennui is want, then you're either engaged in some kind of struggle around a lack or you're bored.
Mm.
So on the axis, there's no like good events. There's only vacillating back and forth between want and ennui, right? I mean, that sense that the only thing worse than being bored would be the shit that happens when you're not bored.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Now it seems like that would mean all of human life is either just being distracted,
right,
you know, not bored,
right,
or being insufficiently satisfied, right? Like not wanting, but not being free from want.
When we talk about doom scrolling, and trust me, I'm going to get back to what you just said. When we talk about doom scrolling, we almost always call it doom scrolling because it results in something unpleasant for us,
mm-hmm,
that perhaps not at the time, but later on reflection, we realize this was horrible. You just said, you know, there's either boredom or distraction. That is distraction from boredom. And so now I'm wondering, while I'm distracted, am I still bored? That is, can I be bored and not know it? Because if I'm really distracted, then I'm not realizing that I'm experiencing boredom. But I feel this way about doom scrolling, which I think is a distraction from a kind of boredom, that at some point I'm like, no, this is making it worse. And what's the it? The it is boredom.
Yeah, I don't know that we are ever bored and aware of our boredom at the same time. I mean, this has been the paradox I've been pushing this whole episode, is that the moment we reflect on it, it's no longer boredom. It's something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that we're ever aware of being bored. Like the moment I say I'm bored, I'm doing something else.
Right.
I've thematized it for myself. This is an aside, but I did not know that's why we called doom scrolling. I thought that we called doom scrolling because initially it was about scrolling through bad news.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
But we talk about it always as something negative. So we talk about scrolling for bad news because it makes us feel bad. But we do it because it's distracting us from what we would be doing, or we feel like we're going to take some pleasure in it. But the reason why it's a topic of interest is because it doesn't bring the pleasure we thought it would.
It's also the case, though, that doom scrolling makes doom boring.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's also true. I thought of something else, Lee, in relation to your position that the moment we think we're bored, we're no longer bored. My sister-in-law constantly says to her children, and children often will say over and over and over again, I'm so bored. I'm so bored. I'm so bored. And their mom, my sister-in-law, will say to them, you know what's boring? You saying over and over and over again, I'm so bored.
Right. Yeah.
And somehow then that becomes a game between the kid and the mom, and then the boredom is broken, at least momentarily.
Yeah.
I think there are times you can be bored and not quite aware of it. One of the things I've sometimes noticed is if I'm reading a novel and I find myself returning to it less frequently, reading in shorter and shorter bits, it takes me a while to suddenly realize, you know what? I'm just not into this. And then when I have that thought, it's like, okay, I should just read something else. But there's always that slow realization that I'm just not engaged by this. Same thing sometimes watching a movie, I'll find my thoughts going someplace else. And then I'll think, wait, if I'm thinking about everything else but this movie, maybe I'm bored by this movie and maybe it's time to just turn it off. And I think this ties into what my self-criticism of doom scrolling is that because the promise is always the possibility that something might engage, it doesn't get me to turn it off or put it down in the same way that something else might. It's this kind of limbo activity. It's not engaging, but because it constantly has the promise of engagement, you do it anyway.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think that we are never bored and aware of being bored. That the moment you reflect on, you know, the state of being bored, that you're no longer bored.
And so I can't even be bored by my reflection on my boredom?
No, I don't think you can. I think that's the least boring thing. You know, there's a poem by Margaret Atwood. I think it's called Boredom or Bored or something like that. But I always remember this line because she says, boredom is for dogs and groundhogs. I mean, I think that that really points to something truly human about boredom in the way that we're talking about boredom. That boredom pushes us to ask, what's the point of it all? And that maybe we don't see that in the rest of the animal world, right? Like dogs and groundhogs can just lay around and be bored. Cows just lay around and be bored. You know, I don't know because I don't speak cow, but I don't think that they're moved to a kind of existential malaise because of that.
But I know.
Do you speak cow?
Well, but I know some people who often I see them sitting for extended periods of time doing nothing. They're not watching TV. They're not listening to anything. They're just sitting. And when I say, what's going on? Is there something wrong with you? You know, they're like, no, I'm fine. I'm just, I don't know. Usually they say I'm thinking about things or something like that. And so, you know, maybe cows are just thinking about things, thinking about the grass they ate yesterday, thinking about walking over to another place in the pasture.
Playing cult leader or cult follower by the other cows.
Yeah, and everybody tune in next week for our episode entitled The Inner Life of Cows. Get it? Parse all this out for
you. Which for me would be completely boring, but I'm not sure it is boring for the cows.
You know, one thing that you often hear from incarcerated people is how boring it is to be incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Just the boredom of it is so much worse than not being free. That seems to really support, I think, the line that we've been following here, which is that boredom is an existential condition that pushes us towards either a confrontation with the absurd or a sort of dread or malaise.
But aren't we now circling back to the fact that boredom is my own responsibility? That is, if I am bored, it's because of me, because I could occupy myself with something. And if I don't, then it's because I don't do something that I'm bored.
But isn't that basically just the definition of responsibility, is like, you know, to make things meaningful? You can't imagine a morally responsible agent that is not invested in responding, right?
Yeah. But you saying that, Lee, now allows me to see something I never saw before. And maybe this is like realizing that the cartoon character Barney Rubble is named after a pile of rubble. So maybe I'm saying something that everyone knew and I never realized it until just now.
I was wondering what that connection was going to be.
This is exactly why the existentialists are talking about meaning construction as really what constitutes human existence. And they're also the ones who are obsessed with boredom. Mm. I don't think there are any philosophers who talk as much about boredom as existentialists do. Mm. And now I'm beginning to see how those two things are connected. Because if human existence is basically meaning construction, then in those instances when I am not constructing meaning, I am facing my own existencelessness, my own lack of existence. And that is terrifying.
But thinking that in the context of the example of prison is, you know, this is the problem with all philosophies of individual subjective responsibility. Like, I wouldn't blame someone for being bored in prison. Right. The institution is set up. The whole structure, the whole way we talk about it is serving time. Its emptiness of time is its function, is its purpose. And there's definitely a point where individual responsibility comes up against its limits of the institution and the situation. And I think this is true in a lot of contemporary discussions about boredom. You know, a lot of the thing about boredom now is this accusation, especially of like kids today, kind of mm-hmm. the old man talk of like they have all these things in front of them and they're still bored. Whereas we had much less to work with. We didn't watch DVDs when we went on car trips. We played games about spotting license plates.
But this goes back to a point that Lee made earlier, namely that if all of the things that surround me already point out the meaninglessness of all things, then I don't need to do that myself. So I'm kind of existing in a state of constant boredom because I'm not even reflecting on my own boredom.
It also really points to why it is that the conditions of incarceration in the United States are fundamentally inhumane.
Yeah.
I mean, prison doesn't have to be boring. You know, we could have prisons and jails where people were being educated, where they were given meaningful things to do, but the boredom is kind of just like another part of the punishment. It's a specifically inhumane punishment.
Yeah.
I mean, think about solitary confinement. I mean, it's the worst possible thing that you can do to a human being. It right. actually breaks the mind down.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's nothing to engage, to respond to make meaning with in solitary confinement.
Right. And that's the moment at which incarceration is neither. Oh, I lost my words.
Just speaking, Cal. Sorry, go ahead.
Incarceration is neither for the purpose of rehabilitation, but also no longer for the purpose of retribution because the punishment far outstrips the crime.
Yeah, no crueler punishment than boredom.
Yeah.
Which sounds flippant. If you had not already listened to this amazingly interesting conversation that we have been having.
But do you know who's not interested by this conversation?
The bartender. Poor guy. He's like, why are they trying to speak
in cow? I'm sorry, I'm back to speaking cow.
No, he's not interested. He's definitely given his last call. So we do have to roll out of here, but guys, I do appreciate you indulging me on this topic. I knew when I suggested that we do an episode on boredom that we were taking a risk, but I think, you know, this one paid off. You must imagine me happy.
I think the risk is real. I think this is why people are reluctant to do real scholarship on boredom, because no one wants to be boring.
Yeah.
So no one really wants to think about boredom that much. And, of course, then there are the paradoxes that have been enumerated over the course of this episode, that if you got interested in boredom, would it even be boredom
right.
anymore?
I once had a seminar as an undergraduate in the philosophy of boredom that actually turned into an exercise in itself. And I think that's the danger you're pointing out, Jason.
And he did 6 to 18 months in that. All right, guys. I'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Take care.